Mini episode 519 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.info.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Welcome, everyone, to mini episode number 519 of the FDH Lounge. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris.
We have a tremendous schedule for you today, reviewing the 2014 NFL season with somebody who has a lot of football knowledge and background to leverage to talk about with us. This is a gentleman who set a number of Ivy League records when he was playing at Princeton back in the 1990s, and also at the time broke some 1AA records and subsequently went on to a career in the NFL. And also dabbled a little bit in the XFL, which I have to believe was a very colorful experience. This is a gentleman who today is a motivational speaker and writer, and we definitely want to get into a little bit of that with him. His Speak Life ministry work that he does is, of course, of a very rewarding nature and spreading a lot of positivity to people. And we are always much in favor of getting a chance to talk about that whenever we have anyone on the show doing such work. For example, our talk with Lex Luger, the times when he's been on the show, it's always been interesting to get into that with him and ways that he is leveraging his life experiences to try to get some lessons to help people out. Of course, you can follow everything he's got going on at KeithElias.com, which means, of course, we could only have with us on the phone lines the one and only Keith Elias. Been looking forward to doing this for a while, getting him on the program. It's a pleasure to have this gentleman on. Keith, welcome to the FDH Lounge today. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great, and I'm very, very excited that we were finally able to get it together so that I could be with you tonight.
Well, very glad to have you on. And, again, you were definitely somebody who, based on all of your experiences on the gridiron, I know we'll have a lot of opinions and insights to share about what we all saw as, I think, in many ways, a very historic 2014 NFL season, one that we're going to long remember. I guess we should start, of course, with Super Bowl 49, and we'll get to the play that everyone is talking about here that swung the whole thing. But in terms of the kind of game itself, I want to start there, and I want to get your thoughts on this, because we saw a situation a year ago where it was an extreme unlikelihood, where you saw an outcome play out that, as I've said on the show previously, maybe you get that 3 times out of 100 where it becomes such a boat racing the one way and it kind of gets out of control. I wonder this year if we didn't see something that was almost equally implausible on the other end, because how many times does a game play out exactly the way everybody's thinking? Everybody said going in, this is going to be probably a 3 or 4 point game. It's going to come down to the very end. A lot of times people say that, and it never really materializes that way, and it did this year. It just seems kind of strange to me. What did you make of that, of New England and Seattle, notwithstanding the strangeness of that play at the end, but it almost followed the script exactly in terms of coming down to the end?
Yeah, you know what I think was that this year that a lot of the variables were better known. And I think that the things were more tangible. We understood, as as you examine the football metrics of it, we knew the matchups a lot easier, let's say, this year than last year. I think last year the Broncos had such an amazing run and such an amazing season that they dazzled, you know, people to a certain degree. And so people didn't analyze it with as fresh of an eye. And this year, I think, going into the Super Bowl, you know, there were a lot of teams that could have made it. And certainly Seattle, it was miraculous for them to get in. So as you looked at it, it was really difficult to see how some of the wide receivers on both sides were going to be able to get open down the field for big plays. The odds were stacked in the defense's favor just on the way that they had been playing. And the only real variables, the X factors, were how much the Deflategate would bother New England, if at all. and really the injuries on Seattle's side, which began to mount up during that game, you know, as well. And not to take anything away, you know, from the New England's fourth quarter and the comebacks. I just think that was a factor in it as well, was the way Seattle was wearing down on the injury front.
Definitely. I would agree with that. And you perfectly anticipated on the wide receivers, and I want to ask you a follow-up question about that. But before I do, on your main point there, I wonder if the way that it played out this year with being as close as it was and being as predictable in terms of following the script in that way, do you suppose that had anything to do with a little bit more closeness on both sides of the ball than we saw last year? Because last year you had the historic great offense against the historic great defense. And this year, Seattle was a little bit off from what they were in 2013, still great, but maybe not historic great. And New England had a better defense this year than Denver did a year ago, versus on the other side of the ball, Seattle was certainly closer to New England offensively this year than they were to Denver last year. So having the greatness dispersed on both sides of the ball this year, did that help account for the closeness and the inability of one team to pull away completely in this one?
Yeah, I do think that, you know, Seattle has been known for the last couple of years as a defense-first football team. And I think New England, instead of trying to meet strength on strength, they nibbled at the defense. They weren't trying to get the big plays down the field. They said, we got a guy in Tom Brady that can nibble on you. He can beat you play after play after play after play after play, where most quarterbacks at some point will make a mistake. And even Tom made a couple in the game that, you know, I'm sure he wished he would have had back. But I think the nature of the makeup of these two teams definitely led to the more competitive game.
I think that's definitely the case as well. And the way that they just kind of kept coming back at each other. And what you said about the wide receivers, that's another thing that I want to follow up on, because I had the sense in watching Seattle all year, and again, I was a guy who picked them wire to wire to repeat. And so I had the sense that in the end they'd be able to get it done. But I kept saying, and we were doing shows every week during the season, just specifically focused on the NFL, I kept saying at regular intervals, it kind of scares me with the wide receivers, because you don't have Harvin there in that role. I think they intended, and I've heard some buzz about this, they intended to promote Paul Richardson to that role, at least on the end of rounds, but he ended up getting hurt. He wasn't really in there. Baldwin and Kearse, nothing to really write home about in my estimation, versus what they had a year ago and with Golden Tate having been in there. And you look at it in the Super Bowl and having to go to Chris Matthews, and it was genius game planning the way that they did it. But you sit there and you go, boy, if it was that fragile and it was dependent on getting lobs to the tall guy, I mean, that wide receiver situation, it almost makes it kind of surprising that they made it as far as they did in a league that really values the passing game, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely a throwback. And I think that's why when, you know, look, if you let's go one game back, I mean, they are miracles away from not being in the Super Bowl, right? Because they came up against and like credit to them, they had home field. If, you know, and they didn't in the Green Bay game, that might have been even something else that would have tipped in their favor. But all things were pointing to the Green Bay-New England Super Bowl. But so I do think that when you look at Seattle, you know, they're so strong in so many areas that instead of calling their wide receivers a weakness, I just think it's not their strength. You know, like I think their wide receivers can play, but they're not, you know, Marshawn Lynch, and who is, you know, in the top five, top three running backs in the league. And so, you know, you lead with your strengths, and the Seattle strengths are their defense and their running game. I do think, you know, at the Super Bowl, I think a wide receiver emerged, right? And probably, you know, sometimes things just click at a certain time of the year, and it certainly clicked for that young man during the game. And hopefully he'll be able to fill the void next year that they were looking for all year.
Well, it will be interesting to see how much of that carries over into the 2015 season, and if he proves to be sort of this year's version of Timmy Smith in the Super Bowl, or if it proves to be a little bit more enduring than that. That was the one guy I was thinking of when it happened, but you know, we'll have to see, I suppose. But and that's a logical segue, I think, right there to the end sequence and the way that the entire game, season, everything turned around on that fateful final play in the end. And the controversy there, it's hard to find a lot that hasn't been said about that call. It's hard to find anyone who really deviates from the consensus that it was a bad call. So I don't necessarily claim to have anything too original here, but there were a couple things that occurred to me that I haven't really heard people talk about that much, and I certainly want to get your thoughts on it. First of all, the way that Seattle just kind of lackadaisically ended up letting two of their three final timeouts go, and then they find themselves on the goal line and in a situation where it then becomes hard to envision running it three times. So I'll start with that point right there. Do you have a sense that that kind of played into it at all, that if they had been able to save one of those two timeouts, if they'd been a little bit less careless with them on the final drive, that they might have had an easier time in their own minds just going for the punch in a couple of times?
Well, I think that having the timeouts may have given them a luxury, but I think the biggest thing that's tricky at that point is trying to figure out how to score a touchdown and also leave New England with no time left. So, like, as they were approaching the goal line and being, you know, sort of an objective, dispassionate guy watching the game, I thought to myself, the biggest problem Seattle has now is not to score too fast. You don't want to leave Tom with a minute left. And so sometimes then, I don't know. I know that they called those timeouts to sort of regroup and get a plan going and that kind of thing, and because you don't want to make the mistake. But I also think, like, you know, it's the biggest day, the biggest time. Time is running out. You want to make sure you have time to score. So, you know, I'm not going to double guess their timeouts. They were doing what they could to get in a position to score. You know, for me, it was actually strange that Belichick didn't call a timeout. Because at that point, I'm like, why is he not stopping the clock? Because they're going to score, and his team won't have any time left. And that's what I thought was going to happen. So, you know, I didn't really think or double, like, I really didn't really analyze them using their time left down at the end, because they have to make sure you score. And so you have to make sure you get the right play in. You have to make sure you take your time and do it right.
Interesting, and I've heard some other people question that as well, and some people come down on the side of Belichick decided on the spur of the moment that if he didn't use any timeouts there, that maybe he could go Carroll and Double into doing something dumb. So do you kind of subscribe to that notion at all? Because it's hard to find a third option here. Either Bill Belichick did a dumb thing and got away with it, or he did a smart thing in terms of trying to goad the Seattle coaching staff into making a mistake. There is no third option, is there, Keith?
No, I don't. But I don't. I mean, I think that if you look at the Super Bowls in the past, he with the Giants, he allowed them to score. Right? He was like, okay, look, we're going to let them score right now, so we have time, and that didn't work for him, and so he might have said, you know what? No, we're going to make our stand right here, right now. And so, you know, who knows? Like, I mean, who knows what went through his head? It's tough. He would have to say what he was thinking and why he didn't call a timeout. So it's impossible to say whether it was a mistake or not unless we know what he was thinking and why he didn't. Now, if Seattle had run the ball and didn't get in, right, and now time is running out, and, you know, then they quickly – and they'll do whatever. They could throw a fade. They could run a quarterback sneak. You could do whatever. And then, you know, call their timeout with 6 seconds left or whatever and then score with no timeout. Then you know, it's all about, like, what would have and could have happened. And so because it worked out in his favor, you can't say he made a mistake, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, anytime you benefit from the outcome of events, it's hard to say that. That's true. But there have been some other.
Let's put it that way. Yeah, it definitely was unconventional at that point that he didn't call timeout because Lynch just had a 4-yard run when he put it 36 inches from the goal line. So
right,
everybody in the world is thinking they're going to get run the same run that they just got 4 yards on. And what Belichick did was they brought in the run defense. They put goal line in. They stacked it. They dared Seattle to throw, and they were basically saying, "You're not going to run it in," with the defense that they put in. But even with that, I mean, really, because Marshawn Lynch, he can run it. You know, so I think that if you're in the booth and New England runs this, brings in the heavy, heavy defense, and they're saying, I dare you to throw. And you know, if you're Pete Carroll, that you only got one timeout left, and you know that you may have to throw in this sequence. It may not be a bad idea to throw now, okay? And I think that's what he was thinking. Let's get the throw out, because it's a touchdown or it's an incomplete. And now we can run a play, call a timeout, and run a play if we have to. I'm sure he would have run no matter what on third down and then seen what happened after that. So I understand where the idea of throwing comes in. But for me, personally, if I was going to throw, there are safer throws. You could throw a fade into the corner of the end zone, or because I've got Russell Wilson, I can run a play action and have him run and get him on the corner and say, Russell, if you run, run it in. If you don't have it, throw it out of bounds. And instead, it was throwing the way they did. It was obviously a high-risk maneuver, and it backfired on him.
Well, let me ask you about that. Let me draw out that specific point, because I have had the same notion about the pass. I am not violently opposed to passing at one of those three downs there, but to me, I can't think of, and not just because of the outcome, I can't think of a more high-risk pass than throwing it into traffic. When you mention a fade, that's exactly what I'm thinking of. I mean, even though at this point of the game they've got one of their taller guys on Chris Matthews and they've made their adjustment, still, you know, a quarterback can make that throw, particularly one as gifted as Russell Wilson, to where in the corner, it's either going to be in the wide receiver's hands or it's going to go out of bounds. There's no third option. You can throw basically the pick-proof pass and try and score that way. So it sounds like you sort of have the same notion I did, that passing may not be the worst thing in the world, but certainly not the way they went about it.
Well, I mean, I'm trying to get in their mind. Like, you know, for me personally, when they came out in that spread offense, I couldn't believe it. Like I said, and my wife was sitting right next to me, and I said, what are they doing? And it was just because, like, and again, you're not on their sideline. Like Pete Carroll said, the play that they called came out of the process of how they run their offense, okay? So that's the way they practiced it. That's the way they do it. I mean, they must have, because New England knew the play. Because that wasn't – he didn't just read – you know, Butler, he didn't read that play. He had seen that play 100 times. He knew that play. He jumped that play. So that must be something that Seattle does often around the goal line, you know. And so they went to what they do a lot. But at that time in the game, with the way they battled down the field, like I thought for sure we were going to see two runs. And then if we don't get in on the, you know, we'll call timeout and save up for that fourth play. And the thing is, you could run the ball there on second down. And if you don't get in, you can call your last timeout right there. And you can, in the huddle, call two plays. You can say, hey, right, we're going to run a play action here. And if we don't get in, we're going to come back with this, you know. And so your third down could have been the play action where they said, Russell, throw it or run it in, or throw it out of bounds. Run it in or throw it out of bounds, and we'll play that fourth down. They could have easily said, after they, you know, done that, and then said in the fourth down, we may run a quarterback sneak. They were 36 inches away. So I thought definitely they were going to run. So that's kind of where my mind approached it. You know, that was your philosophy to me watching them all year. We run the ball, we play defense. And this was an ample opportunity to say to your linemen, if you want to win the Super Bowl, you move your guy 36 inches.
Yeah. And again, I believe still that the specific play call, I think, was a dumb one, because you're throwing it into traffic. Plus, you leave yourself open, as you said, to New England diagnosing the play, which was key to the entire thing. Because if New England reads it completely, then you're really in the high danger zone, as it happened to be on that play. But going into that, it is interesting. I don't know if you've seen any of the pictures that have come out subsequently. I saw it tweeted a number of different places the next day. When Russell Wilson was cocking the ball and preparing to release it, there was nobody near Waquette. He was wide open. It looked like an easy throw. That break on the ball was just violent as far as jumping the route, getting in there, and materializing really in the blink of an eye. And again, to me, Bevel coming out and throwing Lockett and to a certain extent Wilson under the bus, to me that's maybe grounds to get fired, if not the initial thing, because I don't think you should blame the players when your play call ends up that way. But having said that, purely on the merits of the play, it did seem like the execution of Wilson and Lockett might not have been all that it could have been, notwithstanding the great play that was made by the defense.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, like, again, if Russell had thrown it lower or a little bit behind him, it's a touchdown. But there's 100 different ifs you could do when you go from there. What if the defensive lineman batted it down? And I think you get to a place with ifs in football where you could go, well, what if he never caught the pass to put him down there? And I think so. All you can really do is say, look, did we put our players in the best situation to be successful? And I think when you have the strength that you have at Seattle, I would have to say no, that there were better options that you could have done to make your team successful. But it's easy for spectators to say that. And that's, I think, where Pete Carroll said the play that they called came out of their philosophy. It came out of their system. It came out of what they do. And it certainly was baffling, obviously, for most of us who aren't privy to the system, right? We're not privy to what they work on,
right,
and what they practice. So for me, it was just, like I said, even when they came out and spread, I said, okay, so as soon as I saw them in spread, I said, okay, so it's a little bit gutsy, but I think that they're going to do the read option here and give Russell the opportunity to give it to Marshawn or take it himself. Not a bad call. And then when they did it was just, I couldn't believe it. So I was like, what are they doing? And then when it was picked off, it was just, I had to leave the room. I just said, I cannot believe what the opportunity that they just took away, you know?
Yeah. Well, as a lifelong Cleveland Browns fan and somebody who has no love lost for Bill Belichick, I assure you I was screaming things at the TV when that went down. But I have to ask you one more question as well, because it just kind of struck me listening to you talk here. Maybe this is an apples-to-apples point of comparison here. With your level of success in the Ivy League, one could say almost akin to what Lynch has done at this level. Now, I don't know if you were in a power running offense or whatever, but it might be easy for you to put yourself in the shoes of that situation, because I'm thinking to myself, Lynch is about as money as it comes, all things being considered, on getting a one-yard carry. But the stakes being what they are, 22 hands that are going to be diving for that football, what do you think, having perhaps been in similar situations yourself, how risky is a run? We tend to think of a run as, oh, well, the worst thing that happens is you get stuffed. But given what you did in your own career, your own experiences playing, how high of a risk do you think there was of a fumble there, even with somebody not prone to fumbling?
I think, like, in those situations, even, like, you tighten up even more. You say to yourself, hey, no matter what, I got to hold on to this thing. But it's sometimes, you're right, like, guys can reach for the ball. Guys can fumble because they're so thinking about crossing the line or reaching the ball out that it does happen. So your point's valid. They could have run the ball and fumble, you know. But, you know, one thing I want to say is really interesting about how our mind as fans works. So this was a play that, you know, Tom Brady had absolutely nothing to do with, right? He's on the bench. And so – it's really amazing to me that, so if Seattle scores, then people go, okay, so Tom Brady's not one of the best quarterbacks of all time. He didn't get the fourth Super Bowl ring. But because Seattle throws an interception, we go, oh, well, Tom is obviously the best of all time because he got his fourth Super Bowl ring. And sometimes it drives me crazy when we look at the greatness of a quarterback based on the Super Bowl victories alone. I think that's part of the equation, but we put too much emphasis on it for me, because at the end of the game, Tom had nothing to do with that. And people say, well, if it wasn't for two miraculous plays, he'd have six. Well, if it wasn't for three field goals, he'd have none, right? So it's not just about Tom. And we always say Tom versus Peyton. They never played it down against each other on the field. I think where Tom showed how an amazing competitor he is in scoring those two touchdowns in the fourth quarter alone. So what if Seattle scored there, I don't think it doesn't make Tom the best quarterback of all time, but just because they didn't, I also don't think it makes him the best quarterback of all time. I think that we have to slow down on that. Super Bowl rings is the only barometer of being a great quarterback.
I agree, and you can find examples of that in the past as well. I mean, Joe Montana unblemished in the Super Bowls, but if John Taylor back in 89, if he channels Jackie Smith against the Cowboys and drops that one, or Jackie Smith against the Steelers, I should say, then maybe Joe Montana's 3-1 in Super Bowls, and we certainly don't look at him the same way. So absolutely, the same applies to games in the past and different factors that are at play. And it's interesting, as you mentioned, Brady there and his place in history, because in the NFC this year, it seemed to me that we saw the sun setting on what I thought was going to be the great decade-long rivalry of Seattle and San Francisco. And you see the 49ers this year slipping into chaos, kind of an unknown as to whether they're going to be able to come out of it next year with a new coach. At the very least, it's very hard to put them close to Seattle's level at this point. So one defining rivalry that may have gone by the boards. Do you think in your mind that the same thing is true in the AFC with Brady and Manning? Do you get the sense that we're going to look back at 2014 as the end of it? Or do you think there may be chapters yet to be written?
Well, I wish I could tell the future on that one. I'd love to, because I played with Peyton, I'd love to have him have one more go-round where, you know, everybody knows it's his last year, so everywhere he goes, he could really just enjoy this last year and of his career. But certainly he seemed to struggle at the end of the year. The last month, he got, you know, tired. You know, physically, Father Time catches all of us. So I don't know what Peyton's going to decide. But if that rivalry is over, then I'd love to see some of the young guys like Andrew Luck. I'd love to see the Colts get some pieces that they don't have and be able to compete in the playoffs in a bigger way against New England. Certainly Baltimore already can, and that game was really a pick 'em. And that's what's great about, well, we could have had a Baltimore-Green Bay Super Bowl, and easily, by the way, not even a stretch of the imagination.
Yes,
the ball bounced
that's true.
Another way, and it was Baltimore-Green Bay, okay? And so
right.
We'd be talking about Aaron Rodgers and Joe Flacco. You know, Joe comes in and wins a Super Bowl, and that's what I mean. Like, then all of a sudden, oh, Joe is he's so much better than we think. And so I think, like, you know, that's the beauty and the wonder and the is what makes the NFL so spectacular, is these games are one and done. They're not series. And really, the parity in the league is wonderful. I think a lot of teams are one position away, one draft pick away from being in a situation where they'll be back. I'm very interested to see how Seattle reacts now with this in the off season, and whether they can come back. And we already know New England will be up in the top at the year end, because that's just, you know, is it Brady, is it Belichick? Well, you know, we're only going to find out 5 years after Tom's gone and Belichick is still coaching. So we'll see how
right.
It all works itself out.
Right. And I can tell you, as a lifelong Browns fan, not every franchise is one fortunate draft pick away from sudden contention, but I understand most of them probably are. And from the dumpster fire of my favorite team, that seems a good segue to talking about some of the off-field stuff in 2014, because we saw a run of ugliness this year, the likes of which we really haven't seen in quite a while. Although, again, the whole spectacle of the last couple of years of the concussion deal, players in retirement who are having health issues, as has been the case with Tony Dorsett in recent days with his CTE being reported on. But between Ray Rice, Adrian Peterson, I know Deflategate wasn't off the field, but there were a lot of off-the-field implications about that and the way that the league handles its discipline. So a lot of shadows, a lot of scrutiny on the NFL coming out of this season. How do you sense it's going to go down as a transformative year for the league in terms of how it comes out of this going forward?
I think that you nailed the right word. It was a transformative year, and I think the NFL has gotten so popular and the spotlight is so bright that things that used to maybe not make the front page, and not just making the front page, they're breaking Twitter, right? So Everybody has an opinion. The court of public opinion is weighing in. And I think one of the interesting things for me this year is that we're seeing where, in the case of Ray Rice at least, where, you know, the NFL was held accountable for his behavior even above the judicial system. There was no outcry against the judge. There was no outcry against the New Jersey judicial system, but there was against the NFL. And so, you know, the commissioner could have hidden behind the law and said, look, Ray served his time, and that's all there is to it. But he recognized that because of the too much is given, much is expected, he said, you know, we need to have policies around this. We need to step up. We need to, you know, if it's a privilege to play this game, then let's embrace that and let's be role models. And you know, and because of that, you're going to get things wrong. Like, there's nothing, you know, we don't have, you know, 200 years of a foundation to rely on in how we do this, right? And so the policies are all brand new. You have to, you know, think about how things affect things going forward, what's fair, you know, thinking about, like, listen, in the Ray Rice situation, it's not easy. Punishing him was punishing Janae. And punishing, so you know, he lost his livelihood, so did she. That's his wife now. So these aren't easy things, you know. But I do think that the commissioner is a man of unbelievable integrity. And he is, trust me, I guarantee you he lost some sleep figuring out what's the right thing to do. And I think that the NFL and the fans can be confident that it may not be perfect, but he's going to get it right. And we'll weather this storm, and we will continue to build a league that can reflect the community and make the community proud.
And there definitely will be some ground that has to be covered in the next year and probably beyond to reverse some of the effects of that. So it will be interesting to see some of the things that are deployed in that. And again, turning, as we always intended to a more positive note on this than some of the NFL's more recent maladies. Definitely want to talk to you as well about what you've got going on as a writer, but also motivational speaker these days. Everything that people can find at KeithElias.com with your Speak Life program that you have. And again, as I indicated previously, we're a big fan of anytime anybody is putting out that kind of positivity and help to other people and the strong kind of values that you're promoting there. So definitely want to have you amplify on that a little bit.
Well, I just think that everybody has a platform wherever you're at, whether you're your school, your job, and everybody has the ability to affect change in somebody's life. And with myself, my wife, my family, we just, you know, we believe that the most important person in your life is the one that you're talking to right at that moment. And we try to live our lives in such a way that that we can, you know, reflect the goodness and the glory of the God that created us and bring his love and his will to this earth. And we try to do that by empowering and inspiring young people and old people alike. And so I speak at schools. I work with the Heroes and Cool Kids program, which is a mentoring program where we work, you know, anti-drugs, anti-bullying, and pro sportsmanship. I also work with the NFL in the player engagement department and player support and services. I was a trained transition coach for the NFL, helping guys in the next season of their life. And I'm really, really involved in my local church, Alive Again Alliance here in Tom's River, in every facet of trying to be a light in the world and help people along this journey we all call life, right? Because, you know,
very
life
well
is important.
Said.
We're all in it together.
Wonderful stuff there. Very, very well said. And, again, the kind of values that I personally can endorse 100%. And yeah, beyond that, I noticed on your Wikipedia page There is a picture of you from a speaking engagement in Iraq in 2008. So obviously this has translated into some appearances before the troops and entertaining and motivating them. So that's probably got to be some of the most meaningful work yet that you've been able to do.
Yeah, no question. And it's neat to stand before people who are real heroes and just have the opportunity to say thank you to them because they're changing the world in a real way.
That's outstanding. That's really got to be some work that enriches the soul, no question about it. And, again, big fan of everything you've got going on. Again, the Speak Life program, you can find out more about it at KeithElias.com. Additionally, on a business level, I want to congratulate you. Merely being able to get KeithElias.com, it couldn't have necessarily been easy. I know a lot of people have been frozen out from getting their own names there, have to settle for the .nets or the .uss or what have you. So I don't know if that was something that you were able to get easily or if you had to work for it, but it's good that you have it, I'm sure.
I got it early on. That's what it was. That's the, that was the key.
Yeah. If you hustle on a lot of things in life, you will have that edge. And obviously that's proved to be good for you and having that as a base because obviously it's easy for people to remember. And, of course, anything that people want to find out can be found at KeithElias.com. And additionally, Keith, anything that we didn't cover along those lines that you think we should underline, please take it away.
No, I think that this has been a great half hour. And I'm really thankful that you allowed me to spend some time with you tonight.
Well, Keith, it was a great conversation. And again, for our stable of people that we love talking football with, I could see you fitting into that quite easily. So I would definitely love to have you back on and continue to break down the wonderful world of football as we go along. It was our pleasure getting to have you on tonight.
Thank you so much and have a great night.
Appreciate it. The same to you, Keith. Thank you so much. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in to mini episode number 519 of the FDH Lounge.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, All Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.